That's not right. 92 days, actually, Philip said. Your in arrears $27,810. Eddie's heart went up in flames, a sudden bonfire. That can't be right.
It is right, Philip said. We sent several notices to your office address.
Eddie eyed the pile of unopened envelopes on his desk. Some new, some older, probably as old as 3 months.
Am I going to lose the house? He asked.
He pictured Grace and the girls standing out on the front lawn in their pajamas, while bank officials barred the front door.
I need a check by Monday, Philip said.
Monday? Eddie thought. Where was he going to get 27 large by Monday? Then he remembered that Night Bill was checking in on Monday, and that Bugsy Greer had agreed to pay in full, in cash, $84,000. 35 of that would go to the girls, 49 of that would be split between him and Barbie. But Barbie didn't know that Eddie had upped the price, so he would have to cash her out at only 17.5, leaving him 31.5.
Brilliant. He said to Philip, I can have it to you first thing Tuesday morning, in cash.
Cash? Philip said.
What are you planning on doing, robbing a bank?
They both laughed.
Philip said, Tuesday morning is fine. Thanks, Eddie.
Eddie was buoyed by his victory, but he knew it was only a quick fix. He needed something big. He needed something real. Where were all the buyers? Nadia had brought in the man she'd been sleeping with from Casper Snacks, saying he was interested in buying a house. Eddie had nearly fainted with relief. Here was a benefit to the side business he hadn't anticipated. The girls would encourage buyers. But, as it had turned out, Nadia's special friend had been too Midwestern, with no clue what investing in the Nantucket real estate market would cost him. He'd taken one gander at the prices and decided to buy Nadia an ice cream instead. Eddie spent Saturday in the office. There was nothing going on, and so he finished the paperwork for the deal with Glenn Daly. He stopped for a drink at Lola on the way home, despite the fact that martinis cost $20. He probably needed to be out more so he could meet people and hand out his business card. But being out cost money that he just didn't have. On the way home from Lola, he drove past the houses on Eagle Wing Lane. He could practically see himself crushed like the Wicked Witch of the East under the foundation of number 9. He couldn't bear to think of how happy and excited he'd been the day he'd closed on those 3 lots. On Sunday morning, Grace was up and out of bed at 6 o'clock, off to the hub to grab the Sunday Boston Globe. She was so excited to see the article that Eddie thought she might spontaneously combust. He tried to feel excited as well, but he was too consumed with worry that the beautiful property she loved so much might be repossessed. He slept until 9:30, a sure sign that he was depressed. When he woke up, the twins were out by the pool, reading.
"Where's Mommy?" Eddie said.
"Upstairs in her office," Hope said. "On the phone."
Eddie set about making scrambled eggs with dollops of cream cheese stirred in, the one breakfast dish that actually seemed to help his heartburn. He used 9 fresh eggs, which was probably too many. But what the hell? The eggs were free. Grace came down from her study, beaming.
"Do you want to see the article?" she asked. "It's magnificent."
"Sure," Eddie said, "since I paid for it."
"Okay,"
Grace said.
"I tried to show it to the girls, but they weren't interested."
"Shocker,"
Eddie said. Grace said, "The photographs were all staged, so don't get jealous."
"Jealous?"
Eddie said.
"Of Benton, silly," Grace said.
She opened the newspaper flat across the sexiest countertop in the world to show the front page photo of Grace feeding Benton a strawberry. "Nantucket's Private Eden," the headline read.
"Nice,"
Eddie said. The photo was a tad suggestive of, well, exactly what, Eddie wasn't sure. Maybe he should feel jealous. He looked at the other photos. Grace on the mower, Grace in the pool, Grace and Benton hanging from the elm tree like a couple of capuchin monkeys.
"Go ahead and read it," she said.
"I'll read it later," Eddie said. "I promise."
The article was long, and Eddie didn't really have the attention span to delve into such an endeavor right then. His brain hurt. He was hungry for his eggs. He was happy that Grace was happy. She'd gotten what she'd wanted. The article was some kind of quest that she'd successfully completed. Eddie wished his life were like that. Instead, it felt as if he were standing nuts deep in icy water, panning for nuggets of gold that he would either spend or lose, necessitating more panning. Endless panning. He looked at the photograph of Grace feeding Benton again, but instead of feeling jealous, he merely felt intrigued. Benton Coe was a successful businessman. Did he have any money he would like to invest in number 13? Eddie plated his pillowy, soft eggs and carried them out to the deck. With the first bite, he closed his eyes, and there he envisioned Benton Coe as some kind of prince who might save them all. Madeline. When Madeline saw the article in the Boston Globe, she thought to herself almost involuntarily, Grace and Benton look so happy. She wasn't sure if it was the article that inspired her, but for the first time in her writing career, Madeline didn't have a single hesitation when it came to ending her book. She felt like Gretchen Green, girl hero, swooping in to set things right. First, there was heightened drama and conflict. G's husband, Renfrew, discovers G's affair by checking her cell phone records. As Madeline understood it, this was how most adulterers got caught. But she knew Grace would never get caught this way because Grace barely used her cell phone. When the affair is uncovered, G leaves her husband and runs away with B. They move to St. John, U.S. Virgin Islands, where B has been commissioned to build an enormous compound of villas overlooking Honeymoon Beach. G takes up bird watching, which aligns with her newfound sense of freedom. She feels like she has wings. Madeline set down her pen and took a deep, cleansing breath. The book was done. Not only did Madeline know that Angie would love it, she knew that it was good. Eddie. When he walked into the office Monday morning, Barbie was already at her desk with two coffees from the Handlebar Cafe and the newspaper open in front of her. Sit, she said. He didn't like her telling him what to do, but something about her tone made him obey. Maybe she was going to confess to her relationship with Glenn Daly. She handed him his coffee, loaded with milk. She nodded at the newspaper. You see this? It was the article about the garden, open to the picture of Grace feeding Benton the strawberry. Yeah, Eddie said, shrugging. Grace said the photographs were all staged. That's what Grace says, Barbie said. But everyone else on this island says that you're paying this guy to screw your wife. Speaking of screwing, Eddie said, how is Glenn? Don't change the subject, Barbie said. You need to get your house in order. I'm serious, Ed. You need to deal with this. Eddie eyed his sister and saw the same girl with the bad perm and too much eyeliner fighting with Teresa Maniscalco outside the high school library because Teresa told everyone in school that the girls' locker room reeked like Barbie's vagina. Eddie could remember hearing the phrase, reeked like Barbie's vagina, and feeling mortified. He wanted to defend his sister's honor, but he'd never been good at facing up to his problems. He was too scrawny. He'd only ever been good at running away from them. Barbie, afraid of no one, fought it out with Teresa Maniscalco, busted Teresa's lip open with one punch, and promptly took a 3-day suspension. Eddie had walked past the main office, and he saw Barbie through the plexiglass window, slumped in a chair, her arms crossed over her chest, glowering with pure steel resolve. He thought, my sister is the toughest person in the world, way tougher than Eddie himself. After that, nobody messed with Barbie. She worked her ass off and was accepted to Boston University, where she favored peasant blouses and learned to read tarot. After she graduated, she followed Eddie to Nantucket. Her first job was working as a personal assistant to a very wealthy woman with a summer estate on Abrams Point, and Barbie absorbed the lifestyle like a sponge. Which wine, which fork, which flowers? She learned about crystal and art dealers and the neighborhoods of Manhattan and Paris. Eddie could not believe her transformation. Maybe he didn't know shit from Shinola, but Barbie presented herself to the world as an elegant and refined woman. And then, of course, she'd always had the sixth sense. That was the thing. Okay, he said.
Fine.
He reasoned with himself the whole way home. Grace was not having an affair with Benton Co. It might have been a schoolgirl crush. Grace enjoyed having someone to talk to about her hens and her flowers, but Grace didn't have it in her to have an affair, Eddie didn't think. She was too programmed to be good. Instilled in her from childhood by her grandmother, her parents, her older brothers. Rebellion for her, Eddie knew, had been drinking tequila and smoking cigarettes. On the same night. On a Tuesday. During her sophomore year at Holyoke. An affair in adulthood would be unthinkable. Right? Eddie's heartburn ratcheted up from the mellow 3 it had been that morning to a 7 and then an 8. And then, when he pulled into the driveway and saw Benton's big black pickup truck, it became a 9. Eddie busted into the house.
Grace!
He called. He raced up the stairs 2 at a time. Fast, Eddie, and barged into the master bedroom. Empty. Then he swung open the door of Grace's study without knocking, something he was forbidden to do because that study was her sanctuary, she said. But the study, too, was empty. Eddie calmed down a bit. He had let Barbie poison his thoughts. Grace and Benton would be out in the garden, weeding and mulching and making plans to build an outdoor shower with doors fashioned out of shutters salvaged from a French farmhouse, and climbing roses. Grace had forever wanted roses in her outdoor shower. See? He did listen. Eddie went through the kitchen and out onto the deck.
Grace!
He called. The backyard was uninhabited, except by butterflies, bees, birds on the feeders. The garden was shimmering as if in some feverish utopian dream. Eddie walked out to the far edge of the property and plunked down in an Adirondack chair. The views across Pulpis Harbor at this time of year were dazzling. He was a lucky man. Just like Barbie, he had come a long way since the days of Purchase Street in New Bedford. He stood up. Where was Grace? He wandered back over the rolling green lawn, past the hammock and the rose bed, past the swimming pool, past the perennials. He stopped at the 5-foot angel statue and said, "Where's Grace?" The statue didn't answer. It just stood there with the same inane, placid half-smile it always offered. Eddie had paid 5 figures for the statue. For that much money, it should respond when spoken to. He laughed at himself. Barbie was such a pill. She put thoughts into his head, and now he was losing his mind, talking to stone figures. Then Eddie saw the shed, the garden shed. He heard Barbie's voice. "You need to get your house in order." He tried the knob. Locked. Why would the door to the garden shed be locked? He pressed his ear to the door. He could hear noises. Breathing, he thought, and movement. He knocked on the door.
"Benton, you're all done here as of right now."
He cleared his throat.
"You're done. And I will not be paying your final bill. You've taken more from me than I owe you. Now I'm leaving, and you will leave right after me, and you will never come back."
With that, Eddie turned and headed around the side of the house into the driveway, past the black pickup, into his Cayenne. He felt preternaturally calm as well as proud of himself for his restraint. He had handled the situation admirably, he thought. Even Grace's grandmother Sabine might have approved. There was no messy confrontation, no fist fight. There were no screamed accusations or denials. Down the road, a couple hundred yards, Eddie pulled off into the parking lot of Pulpis Harbor, and he waited. By the time he counted to 10, Benton's truck drove past. So Eddie was right. They had been in the locked garden shed together. They had been. Here, Eddie broke down. He didn't cry, exactly. He never cried. But his breathing changed. Grace, his Grace, whom he had first set eyes on as she served blueberry pancakes at the Morning Glory Cafe. She hadn't struck him as beautiful so much as wholesome. She had those big brown, innocent eyes and a perfect smile. When she got embarrassed, the tops of her ears turned pink. She was the kind of girl Eddie had always wanted to marry, the kind who would put home and family first. And she had. Until that summer. Or possibly last summer. How long had this thing with Benton been going on? Eddie couldn't bear to know. He realized he wasn't perfect. He realized he was so obsessed with making money that he'd let everything else fall to Grace. She did the housework and prepared all the scrumptious meals. She did the shopping and took care of the girls. She'd gotten angry once and asked Eddie if he even knew what grade the twins were in. He had become indignant and said, "Of course I do. They're in third grade." But the answer had been fourth grade, and Grace had said to him, "I'm never going to tell them you got it wrong, because they will be devastated. But really, Eddie, make an effort." He had tried harder after that. He showed up at Allegra's Thanksgiving play and Hope's flute concerts, even when it meant rescheduling an important showing. He had taken Allegra to New York City for the modeling interview. But Grace had been angry about that, too, saying that Eddie expended energy on the girls only when there was glory to be reflected upon him. He knew that as a wife, Grace probably wasn't as happy or fulfilled as she might have been. For a long while, she compared herself and Eddie with Madeline and Trevor, a losing proposition every time. Trevor and Madeline held hands everywhere they went. Trevor bought Madeline flowers. Trevor always referred to Madeline as my bride instead of my wife. Trevor watched romantic comedies with Madeline, and they had taken ballroom dancing lessons together. Eddie had sneered at the dancing lessons, which had made Grace cry, presumably because Eddie had let her down in the ways she described and in other ways he couldn't even imagine. But what good would wallowing in his inadequacies do him? Eddie collected himself, and then he drove back to work. When he walked into the office, Barbie raised an eyebrow at him. "Handled," he said. Grace called the office an hour later. Eloise said, "Your wife is on line one." Eddie said, "Put her through to my voicemail." At 3 o'clock, Eloise approached his desk. Gone was her super sweet and helpful manner. That had vanished into thin air a few weeks earlier. "Edward," she said, "I'd like my paycheck."
"What paycheck?" Eddie said.
He paid Eloise every other Friday. She made $20 an hour. "For last week and this week," she said.
"It's only Monday," Eddie said. "I'll pay you Friday."
"I'd like my paycheck," Eloise said. She was wearing her no-nonsense expression, which scared Eddie a little bit. Eloise's husband was a coffin. They had 4 children and 13 grandchildren and were related to just about everyone. Eddie couldn't really afford to piss Eloise off, but he didn't have $1,600 in the office account to give her.
"It's only Monday," Eddie said again. "Do you mind me asking why?"
"I've gotten myself into a situation," Eloise said, "and I'd like the money today."
"I can give it to you tomorrow," Eddie said, thinking of night bill. "In cash."
"That won't work," Eloise said. "I need it now." Eddie couldn't believe the way the women in his life were talking to him today. It must have been poop on Eddie day. But nobody had bothered to warn him. He brought out the company checkbook and cut Eloise her check. "Thank you," Eloise said crisply. Eddie nodded. If she tried to deposit it today, it would most certainly bounce. When both Eloise and Barbie were out for lunch, Eddie listened to Grace's voicemail. She said, "Hey, the girls are both home tonight, so I'm going to marinate some ribeyes and roast those fingerlings you like and shuck some corn. I was hoping we could have a nice family dinner." Then she dissolved into tears. She bleated out, "I'm so sorry," and hung up. Eddie worked until 6, and then 6 became 7. Both Eloise and Barbie left for their lovely little lives outside of work. Eloise had her check tucked safely in her purse, no doubt, and was off to deal with her situation. At 7:10, Eddie's cell phone rang, and he figured it would be Grace, asking when he would be home for dinner. As lovely as grilled steaks and corn and a good bottle of red wine and the company of his wife and daughter sounded, he couldn't go that far. He would not be placated by fingerling potatoes when he'd caught his wife sleeping with the gardener. He couldn't just play through as though nothing had happened, as though nothing had changed. He needed to talk to someone. He needed a friend. He pulled out his phone and dialed the chief's super-secret cell phone number.
"Hey, Eddie," the chief said. "How are you?"
"I'm great," Eddie said, a little too enthusiastically. The chief had said Eddie could call if he needed a hand, and Eddie needed one now. He didn't necessarily want to share what had happened. He just wanted another man to talk to.
"Are you free tonight? I'd love to meet you somewhere for a drink. How about the Brant Point Grill in 20 minutes?
"I have plans tonight, Eddie," the chief said. "Sorry about that."
"You don't have to be sorry," Eddie said. "It's really last minute. I've just had a day. Could you meet me later, say around 10?
If the chief could meet him at 10, Eddie could grab a burger from Lola and linger until 9:15, when he would slip out to 10 Low Beach Road to collect the cash, and then make it to the Brant Point Grill by 10.
"10, the chief said. "That would put me out past my bedtime. Sorry, Eddie."
"Are you sure?" Eddie said. "Nothing I can say to persuade you?" It was embarrassing, supplicating like this. But Eddie was near desperate to connect with someone who had nothing to do with his family or work or his diabolical side business.
"Maybe another time," the chief said.
His tone of voice was verging on irritated, and Eddie didn't want to be an itch. So he said, "Okay, chief, no problem," and hung up. Eddie sat in the office until the sun went down and the room grew dark. Out on the street, Eddie watched people headed out for their delicious summer evenings. Groups of teenagers loped toward the juice bar for ice cream sundaes. Parents pushed strollers to the playground at Children's Beach. Couples held hands on their way to dinner at Oran Moore or the club car. How Eddie would have loved to be picking up Grace and taking her to dinner at the club car. They could have ordered the caviar, which was served with an icy shot of vodka. Afterward, they could have sung at the piano bar. He would even have sprung for the $20 it would have taken to get Ryan to sing Tiny Dancer. He would have done it for Grace. She loved Elton John. He was so lonely. But he didn't have to be. He could go home for dinner. He could go next door to Lola, get himself a martini and a burger, and maybe hand out some business cards. In the dark, the office was downright gloomy. His depleted empire. Eddie finally turned on a light. He forced himself to go through the pile of unpaid bills on his desk. There on top was a bill for $2,400 from Hester Phan, her success bonus. That did it. Eddie felt as if he were falling into a fiery pit of anger and indignation. Success bonus his ass. He picked up the phone and made the call he'd been wanting to make all day. After Benton left the office, Eddie drove out to Low Beach Road. He was still shaking. Grace, Grace, Grace. He'd come so close to losing her. Eddie tried not to regret what he'd just done, but a part of him wished he had just gone home. He thought about Grace, coating the ribeye steaks with her magic marinade. He pictured her drizzling the fingerling potatoes with olive oil, sprinkling them with sea salt and coarsely ground pepper, and shucking some Bartlett's Farm corn. Both Hope and Allegra would still be in bathing suits, lying in chaises side by side at the pool reading. When Grace called them to set the table, they would dutifully rise to go help. They would even pick up their towels and deposit them in the outdoor hamper where they belonged. Then Hope would go to the silverware drawer and Allegra would pull out four plates. Together, they would head out to the deck. Eddie would pull a great vintage of Ponzi Pinot Noir from his cellar. Grace would be so happy with his choice that she would raise her face to him for a kiss. When he got home tonight, Eddie decided he and Grace would have a talk. They would start fresh. No more Benton Co. And for his part, Eddie would give up 10 Low Beach Road. He couldn't ask Grace to end her affair until he cleaned up his own dirty mess. This week was it. The end. He would meet with his accountant, Frank, and they would decide which of Eddie's two commercial properties to put on the market. Even with the mortgages, he could probably still clear a decent profit. Money couldn't buy happiness, except when it could. He would figure it out. He just had to take care of this one last thing. At 10 minutes to 10, Eddie was sitting in his Cayenne outside 10 Low Beach Road. The air conditioning in the car was on, but not the radio. Eddie had a cold bottle of water and a container of cherry Tums in the console. His hands were shaking. A car pulled up behind his, Nadia's Jeep, and Nadia and the other girls climbed out. Their hair was piled into high confections, with curled tendrils framing their faces. Their makeup was thick and bright. It reminded Eddie of icing on a cake. They wore short skirts and teetered in stilettos. They were giggling and teasing one another in Russian. They seemed happy, bordering on joyful, and Eddie tried to let the sound of their voices soothe his hot, aching conscience. These young women were here to prostitute themselves, but at least they seemed to be enjoying it. Or maybe what Eddie was witnessing was bravado or giddy anticipation of what they might consider easy money. After all, it was better than cleaning toilets, right? Less demeaning? Eddie had no idea how the girls viewed it. In his heart, he knew this whole business was repugnant. Eddie's parents would be so ashamed that it pained Eddie to think of it. He wished Barbie had offered to come with him tonight, but she never offered. She just sat at her desk with her pens and notepads from the exotic hotels where she met Glenn Daly, and she waited for Eddie to hand over her portion of the cash. "I'll leave my cell on," Barbie had said before she left work, "in case you need to call me." "I don't see any reason why I would need to call you," Eddie had said. He wondered if Barbie had had a bad premonition about tonight, or if she'd checked the tarot cards, or tea leaves, or her goddamned crystal ball. But when he asked her, she said, no, I'm saying just in case," whatever that meant. When the girls saw Eddie, they erupted in cheerful greetings. Eddie, hi. Nadia kissed him on the cheek, leaving, he was sure, fat, juicy lip prints. Elise and Gabrielle linked their arms through his, and although he desperately wanted to disengage himself, he couldn't risk offending them or dampening their moods. He tried to tell himself that the girls were merely going to entertain the gentleman in residence. Nadia would juggle. Julia would sing Send in the Clowns. Elise and Gabrielle would be a third and fourth in bridge. Together, the six of them approached the side door of 10 Low Beach Road. The girls were quiet as Eddie knocked. Two raps, then one. A very tall, lean man with crooked teeth opened the door. This was Bugsy. He was wearing a blue t-shirt, jeans, and a Minnesota Twins baseball hat. He looked slightly less terrifying than he had on the internet. "Greetings," he said. He opened the door wide and ushered them all inside. Eddie let the girls precede him, and then he too entered. The side door led right into the humongous gourmet kitchen, which was lit only by ivory pillar candles. Set out on the Carrara marble countertops were a lavish spread of sushi and ice buckets holding bottles of Cristal champagne. The girls tried to contain their squeals of excitement. This was how it should be done. A proper wooing, although plenty of times this summer they had walked in on pizza boxes and a tower of empty beer cans, and one time on a half-eaten chocolate cake that had been crawling with ants. Nadia had confided that sometimes the mess was so bad the girls became distracted because they knew they would be coming back in the morning to clean up. "It killed the mood, you know, Eddie," Nadia had said, "thinking we the girlfriend tonight, but tomorrow we the maid." Sushi was the girls' particular favorite, and they loved champagne. Bugsy said to Eddie, "Want to stay for a drink?" No, thank you," Eddie said. He wasn't comfortable being inside this house. He wanted to get the money and go. "You wear that hat all the time?" Bugsy asked. "Even at night?" Eddie nodded. "You get it in Cuba?" Bugsy asked. "Ecuador, actually," Eddie said. He was used to explaining that, although it was called a Panama hat, it was made in the town of Monte Cristi, Ecuador. "You self-conscious because you're bald?" Bugsy asked. Bugsy was also bald. He touched the brim of his ball cap. Eddie didn't want to discuss with Bugsy the things about himself that made him insecure, but he feared that to deny the statement would only invite a rebuttal. "Yeah," Eddie said. "A little, I guess." He had started wearing the Panama hat in his late 20s when his hair started to fall out. Bugsy reached out to bump fists with Eddie. Then he put two fingers among his crooked, ruined teeth and gave a sharp whistle. Instantly, other men appeared in the kitchen, and within seconds, all of the girls were paired up, except for Nadia. Nadia, it seemed, belonged to Bugsy. Eddie couldn't bear to watch this strange courtship ritual. Already, Elise was kissing a man with black, slicked-back hair like a vampire's. Eddie turned to Bugsy, but found himself unable to broach the matter of payment. It was Nadia who came to his rescue. She said, "Why don't you give Eddie money so he can vamoose?" Bugsy tweaked Nadia's nose, as if she were his precocious niece, and then he indicated that Eddie should follow him out the side door. Eddie was only too happy to leave. He waved at the girls and said, "I'll see you ladies tomorrow." None of the girls responded. They were working. He had ceased to matter. As soon as they stepped into the mild summer night air, Bugsy produced a padded envelope about the size of a feather pillow. So much money. Eddie did his best not to seem grabby.
"They'll come every night this week?" Bugsy asked.
"Yes,"
Eddie said.
"Well then,"
Bugsy said,
"for services rendered."
He presented the envelope to Eddie formally, with two hands.
"Thank you,"
Eddie said.
"Thank you,"
Bugsy said. There was a sudden strong grip on Eddie's shoulder and a blinding light in his eyes.
"Whoa,"
Eddie said. His Panama hat fell to the ground, and Eddie heard the unmistakable crunch of foot on straw, which made him wince. His third hat this summer. His final hat. Inside, one of the girls screamed, and a second later, more girls were screaming. Eddie's hands were wrenched behind his back. He was being cuffed. A man with a salty South Boston accent read Eddie his Miranda rights. He was under arrest. The girls were screaming. Were they being hurt? Eddie wondered. Suddenly, Nadia popped out the side door and said, "Hello, Eddie, please, we need help inside." Her voice was calm and casual, as if they had blown a fuse or required his assistance in opening a jar of pickles.
"Miss," the Southey accent said, "stop right there, please. FBI.
FBI, Eddie thought. He wanted to run. He was fast Eddie, the finest track star to come out of New Bedford High School in 35 years. If pressed, he knew he could still sprint a quarter mile in under a minute. He could be halfway to Sankaty Head Lighthouse before anyone knew in which direction he'd gone. But then what? He lived on an island. He closed his eyes and waited for the flames to start climbing the walls of his chest. He thought of Grace, asleep in their California king bed with the feather-top mattress. Grace. He pictured her washing the dinner dishes. He pictured lifting up her thick, dark hair and nuzzling the back of her neck, a move from early in their relationship that he had long ago abandoned. He should have stayed home, eaten the steak and the fingerlings that she had made especially for him. He should have made love to his wife, tried to make her laugh again, tried to make her happy again. But then he reminded himself that the only way he had ever known to make Grace happy was by giving her everything her heart desired.
"That's why I needed the money," Eddie said to the man behind him, whom he still could not see. "It was for my wife."
"Save it for the judge," the Southey accent said.
"If you let me go, I'll figure out something different to do for Grace," Eddie said. "Something better."
"You can figure it out in prison," the Southey accent said. "You'll have plenty of time."
The girls filed out of the house in a tight line, like they were being marched by Stalin. All of them were crying.
"Eddie!"
Nadia cried out. Instinctively, Eddie tried to free his hands.
"Easy, buddy,"
the Southey accent said. He led Eddie toward the back of a black Suburban. Eddie thought of the chief turning him down for drinks. "I have plans tonight." Did the chief know about this sting? He must have. Eddie had thought they were friends.
"You're a good guy, Eddie. A really good guy."
Realizing just how untrue this was, broke Eddie's burning heart. Grace. Something about the article in the Boston Globe changed things for Grace. Seeing the photos of her and Benton, and reading the text describing the wonderland they had created together, had been so validating. It was a depiction of her private Eden. Grace knew it was crazy, but she felt as if she were the only woman on earth, and Benton the only man. When Benton came to the house on Monday, Grace was consumed with a crazy, searing desire For the first time ever, she pulled him into the garden shed. She kissed him and said, I'd really like to marry you.
One little problem, Benton said. You're already married.
I don't care, Grace said. Benton touched her face. You can't just up and leave.
What about the girls?
They need you. This time next year, they'll be headed to college, Grace said.
Yes, but a year is a long time, Benton said. You're not seriously considering leaving Eddie now, are you?
Was she? If she were in a position to talk it over with Madeline, Madeline would say, You have two children, Grace, and a beautiful home. Are you prepared to give that up? Benton Coe is a talented man, but he has no roots here. He lives in an apartment above his office. He gallivants around the world all winter. He probably doesn't even have health insurance.
I'm sure he has health insurance, Grace would retort. She could now picture herself and Benton as a viable couple. Despite what everyone else thought, Grace didn't require much in the way of creature comforts. She could live out of a backpack. She could handle a winter in Morocco or Palm Beach, someplace warm and exotic, away from her endless responsibilities as a wife and mother.
I'll do it, she said. I'll leave at the end of the summer.
You're talking crazy, Grace, Benton said, but I like it.
He growled and put his lips to the most sensitive part of her neck. As they had so many times before, they were making love in the garden shed until Grace heard Eddie's voice.
Grace!
It was all Grace could do not to shriek. She struggled to get back into her sundress and fix her hair while Benton pulled his shorts up, whispering profanities. Grace put a finger to her lips. They needed to stay quiet. It sounded like Eddie was on the deck. When he went searching for her elsewhere, she and Benton could slip out. But Eddie wasn't stupid. Benton's truck was in the driveway, and Eddie had probably already checked the house, and here was the worst thought. The gardening shed had four windows, although they were high up, and Eddie would need a ladder. But if he got a ladder and peered in the window, he would see them. The longer Grace and Benton waited to open the door, the worse it would look. Every second they waited was bringing them closer to destruction. There wasn't even anything to busy themselves with in the shed. What would she and Benton say they'd been doing? There was silence for a long moment, and Grace thought, Open the door. No, keep it close and locked. Maybe Eddie would go back to work. What was he doing home, anyway? Benton was sweating buckets. He looked pale and nauseated, and Grace thought he might vomit in the copper sink. She needed him to be calm, take charge, tell her what to do. Then there was a sharp knock on the door of the shed, and they both jumped. Please God, Grace thought. She was an adulterer, about to be caught. She had no business resorting to prayer, but that was what she did. She whispered a Hail Mary.
Eddie said, Benton, you're all done here as of right now. You're done, and I will not be paying your final bill. You've taken more from me than I owe you. Now I'm leaving, and you will leave right after me, and you will never come back.
Benton nodded sharply. He was shaking. Why didn't he open the door and stand up to Eddie? Why didn't he say, You just can't order me off this job. I've done nothing wrong. Or since that wasn't quite believable, why didn't he just tell Eddie the truth? I'm in love with your wife. I'm going to marry her. Instead, Benton winced, and Grace actually thought he might cry. Then they heard Eddie retreat. They heard the engine of his car. He was leaving, just as he'd said. Benton looked at Grace. I'm going. But, Grace said, I thought... Benton said, When word about this gets around, it is going to be so bad, Grace. Bad for you, but really bad for me. I could lose my business. I will lose my business, for sure. I can't stay here. He pulled at Hank's of his ginger hair. I can't believe I was so stupid. Jesus! Grace didn't like the way he was talking. She said, 10 minutes ago you said you liked hearing how I would give everything up for you. 10 minutes ago we hadn't gotten caught, Benton said. And when I said you were talking crazy, I meant it. This is make-believe, Grace. I'm not saying it hasn't been wonderful. It was fun and exciting and sexy, just like a summer romance is supposed to be.
It's more than a summer romance, Grace said. I've already decided to leave.
No, don't do that, please. He opened the door to the shed, and sweet, cool air filled the space, but Grace found she couldn't breathe.
I have to get out of here, Benton said, and he strode away, disappearing around the side of the house without a look back at Grace.
A few seconds later, she heard the engine of his truck. She thought, he's leaving me. He's leaving me. In the minutes that followed, Grace called Benton's cell phone 7 times and left 5 voicemails. She sent him 4 text messages of varying lengths. In return, there was silence. Grace called Eddie's office. She needed to tell him that no matter how angry he was, he couldn't tell anyone about what he'd discovered. If he did, all of their lives would be ruined, his, hers, Benton's, and the twins. But Eloise answered and delivered Grace's call to Eddie's voicemail. Grace was afraid that either Eloise or Barbie would listen to the message, and so she talked about dinner plans, steaks, potatoes, and corn. Then she broke down and hung up. Eddie wouldn't talk to her, and could she blame him? Just then a text came in from Benton. Grace was flooded with relief until she read it. It said, I'm leaving the island tomorrow. There's an opportunity in Detroit I've been considering for a while. I'm going to pursue it and let Donovan run the business here. We were careless and impetuous, Grace, and I accept 50% of the blame. I wish you well. You will always be my first lady. XO. B. Grace couldn't believe how hurt she was by his choice of words. He wished her well? He was moving to Detroit? They had been careless and impetuous? XO? They had been in love. Who cared about Benton's career or Grace's reputation? What did those things matter? He accepted 50% of the blame? That was big of him. Detroit? He had been considering it for a while? But this was the first Grace had heard about Detroit. Would McGovey meet him in Detroit? McGovey was from Ohio, right? And Ohio bordered Michigan, so safe to say McGovey would probably move to Detroit and teach sailing on the lake. Benton had probably been considering going back to McGovey for a while. She would always be his first lady. But what did that matter if she didn't end up with him? Careless? He made it sound like they had forgotten to wind the garden hose or check the pool filters. Impetuous. Grace knew what the word meant, but she looked it up anyway, acting or done quickly, without thought. He couldn't have said anything that would have made her feel worse. He didn't love her. The shout-out on Lucretia Mott Lane had been a drunken lie, and his subsequent declarations further lies. He hadn't stood up to Eddie. He had acted afraid of Eddie when he could have easily taken Eddie over his knee and spanked him. He wished her well? What ensued for Grace was nothing short of total devastation. She couldn't stand to look at the gardening shed. She would gladly hire someone to come knock it down. She wanted to pour gasoline over the roses and set them on fire. She wanted the whole yard to burn. She climbed into her Range Rover and drove like a bat out of hell to Benton's office. It was still not quite noon, and all of the work trucks were gone, including Benton's black pickup. Where was he? She just needed to see him. She needed a few calm moments to talk this through with him. Eddie wouldn't say anything to anyone. He didn't like sharing news that reflected poorly on him. No one would ever know what had happened. Benton could stay here, or Grace could go with him to Detroit. No, she thought immediately. She couldn't leave the twins like that. There was just no way. She parked the car haphazardly and raced up the steps to Benton's apartment. The door to his place opened, and a young bearded man with glasses and a pork-pie hat stepped out. Hi, he said. Can I help you? I'm looking for Benton, Grace said. Is he here? He's out in the field, I do believe, the man said. I'm Donovan, his manager. Do you have a question or a problem? Both, Grace said honestly. Then she felt like a total fool. I'm Grace Panchik. Oh, right, Donovan said. I thought you looked familiar. I saw the spread in the Globe. That was some great press. We've picked up 3 new clients from that already. Great, Grace said. She tried to smile, but her face would not obey. Listen, I really need to get a hold of Benton. Did you try his cell? Donovan asked. I did, Grace said. She wanted to ask if she could sit in the apartment and wait for Benton to return, but it was also Donovan's apartment and Leslie's, and Grace realized that her behavior now was bordering on psychotic. Do you know where in the field he is? I really need to speak to him in person. Donovan held out his palms as if checking for rain. Benton is his own man, he said. He doesn't share his schedule with me or anyone else. Grace took a deep breath. Okay. But you might check Edith Alleman's house. Donovan said. He goes there Mondays and Fridays. Edith Elliman's house, Main Street.
Thank you,
Grace said. She hurried back down the stairs, but then she turned around.
Donovan, she said, do you know anything about Benton going to Detroit?
Donovan said, I knew he was considering it, but last I checked he hadn't made a decision. Grace climbed back into her Range Rover and drove toward Main Street. Sure enough, at number 808, Benton's truck was in the driveway. And right there in the front yard were Benton and the legendary Mrs. Allamand. Benton was holding both of Mrs. Allamand's hands, and Mrs. Allamand was talking. If Mrs. Allamand had been any younger than 85 years old, Grace would have felt jealous. Grace pulled up in front of the house, chagrined at her own audacity. The voice of her grandmother, Sabine, begged her not to make a scene, but there was nothing else she could do. She had to talk to him. He noticed the car, and a concerned expression came over his face. He said something to Mrs. Allamand, then loped toward Grace's car. Grace loved the way he walked. She loved everything about him. She was a total goner. He poked his head through the open passenger side window.
Grace, he whispered, what are you doing here? I need to talk to you, she said. Do you understand how inappropriate this is? He asked. Do you know how this looks?
I don't care how it looks, Grace said. And you used to not care. When you kissed me on Lucretia Mott Lane.
I have a business to run, Benton said. And you have a family. Go be with your family, Grace. Take care of your daughters. Work things out with Eddie. Please, please don't make this any harder than it has to be. Please don't stalk me like this again, okay? It's making me a little nervous.
Stalking? Grace thought, indignantly. She wasn't stalking. But here she was, in front of Mrs. Allamand's house, and Donovan was sure to tell Benton that Grace had stormed the office.
Stalking?
You still owe Hope that list of 100 books, Grace said. You can break my heart, that's fine, but don't disappoint a 16-year-old girl. From the yard, Mrs. Allamand warbled out, Is everything okay, Benton? Benton waved at Mrs. Allamand, then gave Grace one last look.
Please, Grace, clean break, okay? You'll be fine. Now, goodbye.
Goodbye. Grace drove off. She wanted Madeline. Madeline was the only person who would understand. The first thing Grace did when she got home was to resign as a member of the Nantucket Garden Club. In an email to Jean Burton, she cited personal reasons. She didn't care what those personal reasons were interpreted to be. She didn't care about anything. She opened her medicine cabinet. She took a Fioricet and tried to focus. Benton was gone. But what about Eddie? Could she still save her marriage? Did she want to save her marriage? She would go out and get those steaks, she decided. She would light candles and pick a bouquet of fresh flowers, and she would try to set things right. In the meantime, maybe Benton would come to his senses. Clean break, okay? Meaning what? Should she pretend as if the postcards from Morocco and the mint tea and the pistachio macarons and the plowman's lunches and the slow dancing on the deck and the photo shoot with the Boston Globe and all their fiery lovemaking in the garden shed had never happened? Detroit? But Eddie didn't come home for dinner. He had to tend to the rental on Low Beach Road, he informed her in a terse text. Grace ate dinner in silence with the girls who chattered with each other about the books they were reading. The food was delicious, but Grace couldn't force down a single bite. She had ruined everything. Her lover was gone. He had proved to be a coward, considering Detroit for a while now, and she had trashed her marriage, just as Madeline had predicted. How do you see this ending? Grace had 4 glasses of wine at dinner, then a 5th, because the girls were going to the movies together in town. Grace wandered upstairs in a bit of a stupor. She found her cell phone, read the text from Benton again. She needed Madeline. Could she call Madeline?
Allegra is a cheater, and you, Grace, are a cheater.
No, she could not call Madeline. As Grace fell asleep, she tried to find a place of gratitude. Her girls were healthy and getting along, and she still had the most glorious property on Nantucket Island. Not to mention her Araucana chickens and a flourishing organic egg business. Exotic chickens and pale blue eggs were all good and fine, but they were no substitute for love. When Grace woke up at midnight, Eddie was still out. Still at the rental on Low Beach Road? Or possibly tying one on at a bar in town? Grace didn't even feel she could text and ask him. She crept down the hallway to her study and looked again at the article in the Sunday Boston Globe. There were her hydrangeas, her roses, her Adirondack chairs, all looking perfectly professionally styled. There was the footbridge and the brook and Pulpis Harbor beyond. There was the gardening shed and the copper farmer's sink, which she now wanted to tear out and deliver to the take-it-or-leave-it pile at the dump. And there were Grace and Benton, seated at the teak table in their accustomed places, raising their champagne glasses and smiling out at all the beauty they had created. She texted Benton, "I miss you." Silence. 11 minutes later, she had meant to wait 15, but couldn't. She texted, "I know you miss me." Silence. There was nothing in the world, she decided, that wounded like silence. Ever since the night of the séance, Grace had harbored mixed feelings about her sister-in-law, Barbie. Two of the women at this table will betray the person on their left. Eddie had been to Grace's left, Grace had been to Madeline's left, and Trevor had been to Barbie's left. Barbie would never be in a position to betray Trevor, and it was pretty clear Barbie wasn't referring to herself anyway. Grace would betray Eddie, Madeline would betray Grace. Barbie had been right. Grace had started her affair with Benton Coe 6 months later. Did Barbie have psychic powers, or had Barbie saying the words influenced Grace's behavior? Grace went back and forth on the question, but she had never viewed Barbie the same way since, and after the séance, Barbie had stopped joining Grace, Eddie, and the twins at the holidays. She claimed this was because she preferred traveling with one of her mystery men, but Grace always felt like Barbie had discovered something rotten about Grace and wanted to distance herself. Besides, Barbie Panchik was by nature a very private person and hard to get close to. Her loyalties lay staunchly with Eddie and the business, and beyond that, with herself. Imagine, then, Grace's surprise to find Barbie Panchik standing over her bed in the middle of the night, shaking Grace awake. Grace cried out. It was a bad dream. Barbie looming over her, the black pearl swinging like a pendulum, her perfume suffusing the atmosphere of the bedroom. "Grace, you have to wake up," Barbie said. "Bad dream?" But no, not a dream. For some unfathomable reason, Barbie Panchik was in her bedroom. Bad something. Something bad. Grace looked to her right. No Eddie. Eddie was dead. There was no other reason why Barbie Panchik would be here. Eddie had found out about Grace and Benton and had killed himself. Grace clamped her hand over her mouth and shook her head. Barbie lowered herself onto the mattress next to Grace and said, "You have to listen to me." "No," Grace whispered. "No, no, 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 no. Eddie is in trouble. There was a misunderstanding at the house on Low Beach Road, and the FBI have him in custody." Grace went back to thinking, "Bad dream." Because what Barbie was saying, even if she was real, which she did indeed seem to be, made no sense. FBI? What kind of misunderstanding could bring the FBI? Barbie handed Grace a glass of water from the nightstand. "I want you to drink this, and then I'm going to tell you some things that you are never, ever to repeat. Do you understand me?" Grace accepted the water and nodded. Barbie would have made a good mother, Grace decided. Barbie said, "The FBI have Eddie because they suspect him of running a prostitution ring on Low Beach Road." Grace blinked, then carefully set the water back down. Barbie said, "Possibly he's admitted to it. He didn't exactly tell me." "Admitted to it?" Grace said. "Ben Winford is with him now, but I think he may have opened his mouth before Ben arrived. Apparently Eddie hasn't watched as much Law and Order as I have." "Law and Order?" Grace asked. Barbie said, "I need you to get dressed. You're going down to the police station to bail him out." "Me?" Grace said. "What about you? Are you coming?" "No," Barbie said. "I need to distance myself from this, for business reasons." "Is it true?" Grace asked. "It doesn't matter," Barbie said, "unless they can prove it." For some reason, Nadia, one of Eddie's house cleaners, was at the police station. Grace blinked, thinking again, "Bad dream, nightmare, the kind where people from different parts of her life showed up in places where they didn't belong. Why would Nadia be here?" It was a mistake. but when Grace was ushered into the back of the station to post Eddie's bail, she saw Nadia, or a girl who looked exactly like Nadia, sitting in one of the interrogation rooms. Grace was so stunned that she took a step backward and peered in the room to make sure. "Definitely, Nadia." Grace heard her say, "I just cleaned the houses," and then whoever else was in the room wisely closed the door. Then Grace saw Eddie's other four cleaning girls sitting on folding chairs in front of the officer on duty. Grace had met them all en masse at one point, but she couldn't remember anyone's name except for Nadia's. The girls were in tube skirts, and they had all removed pairs of very high-heeled shoes. One girl was rubbing her feet. One girl was softly crying. They smelled sharp and antiseptic, like hairspray and cheap perfume. They looked, well, here Grace sighed. They looked like hookers. Eddie had been using his cleaning crew as prostitutes. Grace's stomach turned. Grace said to the officer, a black woman striking enough to be a supermodel, whose name tag read Peters, "I'm here to post bail for Edward Panchik." There was much whispering from the girls. One piped up and said, "You are Eddie's wife, yes?"
"No talking,"
Officer Peters said. Grace turned to face the girls. "Yes," she said. At that second, the door down the hallway opened and Nadia came walking out, attended by a square-necked man with a silver crew cut and a navy FBI windbreaker. "Hello, Mrs. Panchik," Nadia said. "What's happening, Nadia?" Grace asked. It could be a mistake, right? It must have been a mistake. Grace could not fathom that Eddie had actually taken these girls, none of them over 25, she didn't think, and turned them into hookers. But Nadia didn't seem capable of explaining. She turned to the other girls and said something in Russian.
"Enough," the silver crew cut barked out. "Cat, do you have a place I can put Ms. Nadia here while I talk to the next one? She should be isolated. They all should, really."
"We can't do what we can't do," Officer Peters said. She smiled apologetically at Grace. "We just don't have enough personnel when something like this happens." Grace nodded as if understanding what this meant. Officer Peters was talking to Grace as if they were in cahoots somehow, and Grace decided to take advantage. She said, "I'd really like to see my husband. Can I see him?"
"Who's your husband?" the silver crew cut asked.
"Edward Panchik."
"Ha," the silver crew cut said. "Better take a seat. It's going to be a while."
"Let me see if I can find a room for Ms. Nadia," Officer Peters said. Nadia said something to the other girls in Russian. Grace wished she could understand. She said, "Are you in trouble, Nadia?"
"Ma'am, please," the silver crew cut said. "I need her isolated. Jesus!"
Officer Peters disappeared down the hall. The silver crew cut eyeballed the five girls. He read names off a clipboard. Elise Anoshkin, Julia Vlachik, Gabrielle Blienkin, Nadia Roskolov, Tanya Yedemensky. The girls raised their hands one by one. The only good thing about finding out Eddie had gotten into this kind of heinous trouble was that it kept Grace from obsessing about Benton. Grace had to triage, and this was definitely worse. At 7 o'clock in the morning, a very weary version of Eddie's normally impeccably dressed attorney, Ben Winford, shook Grace awake in her chair. Ben said,
"Eddie's gotten himself into a real pickle this time."
Ben stared up at the ceiling, which made Grace stare at the ceiling.
"Why don't my clients ever call me before they break the law? I'll tell them 10 times out of 10 it's not a good idea. What did Richard Nixon teach us? What did the Boston bombers teach us? Criminals always get caught."
"Is he going to jail?" Grace asked. Her voice sounded like broken crackers after the Fioricet, the wine, and nearly no sleep. She thought of being in the garden shed with Benton. It had been the previous morning, less than 24 hours earlier, and yet it seemed like weeks ago.
"Oh, probably," Ben said wearily.
He was, Grace realized, wearing his pajama top with his jeans.
"This isn't exactly my specialty, but I know a guy in Boston who handles racketeering, prostitution, more mob-type stuff. You know me, I'm basically a real estate planning guy."
"Mob-type stuff?" Grace said. She felt as if she were going to faint. Ben patted her knee.
"The good news is you'll get him out of here today."
Eddie was released 3 hours later at 10 o'clock. His bail was set at $15,000. Grace tried to pay using their platinum American Express, but it was denied, so she ended up writing a check. When they finally got out to the car and Grace told Eddie this, he laughed like an inmate at the asylum. he said.
The check will bounce, Grace. We're broke.
What does that mean? Eddie shrugged.
I guess as soon as they figure out the check is no good, they'll come for me.
No, what does it mean that we're broke? Grace asked. How can we be broke? She listened in silence as Eddie told her. The money was all gone. The spec houses were a financial noose around his neck. He'd sold 2 of the 3 to Glenn Daly, of all people, but that had only helped to pay Eddie's backed-up debts. Number 13 Eagle Wing Lane was still $150,000 or $200,000 away from completion, and Eddie had exhausted his options. He hadn't sold a house in 9 months. The market was a wasteland. He had managed to keep corporate groups at 10 Low Beach Road, but that had only led him into this mess.
Yes, Grace said. Let's talk about this mess. What the hell's going on, Eddie? What have you done?
I can't tell you, Eddie said. If I tell you, they might be able to get you for conspiracy.
They will not get me for conspiracy, Grace said, because I knew nothing about it, but you are going to tell me right now.
I can't, Eddie said.
Tell me,
Grace screamed. Eddie held his face in his hands. Grace thought he might cry, and that would have frightened her because Eddie never cried. He hadn't cried when either of his parents died, and he hadn't cried when Hope had been born blue. He hadn't cried over finding Grace with Benton in the garden shed yesterday morning.
Would he cry now, at his own ruin?
No. He raised his head and said, I needed money, and last year I had a client who had asked about the girls. Could they come over and hang out with the guys? And last year, I said no way. But then this year I got in such deep water, Grace. I can't tell you how bad things got money-wise, and I needed cash. And the guys who rent this house, baby, they are just loaded, so loaded that they pay $10,000 per night.
Grace gasped.
A ton of jack, right? And I needed it, but I wouldn't have forced the girls. I asked them, just asked, what if? And they were all excited. It's a lot of money for them.
They're immigrant girls that you can exploit, Grace said. What did you expect them to say? I think I'm going to be sick.
The girls never complained, Eddie said. I think they saw themselves as Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman. They loved the money. The money was ridiculous, for me and for Barbie, too.
So Barbie is in on this? Grace said.
No. Eddie. Yes, Eddie said. Yes, she's in on it. But the authorities don't know that, and they're not going to know it. I need Barbie to keep the business afloat while I'm...
in jail,
Grace said. The words were incomprehensible, but she had to accept that they might be true. Eddie might be going to jail. Ben Winford had said, oh, probably. Grace swallowed. Something else was nagging at her.
Eddie, did you sleep with any of the girls?
No, Eddie said. God, no, I have never been unfaithful to you. Grace nodded. She believed him. You're the unfaithful one. You were having an affair with Benton Coe under my nose in my own house.
Grace was quiet.
Well, he's gone. It's over.